Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. All brought to you by Dollar Shave Club. Right now, you can join Dollar Shave Club for just $5 with free shipping. You get the executive razor and trial sizes of shave butter, body cleanser, and the One Wipe Charlies, all at dollarshaveclub.com/martini. More on that a little bit later in the podcast. Jim, let's start with our good martini. And today's might be better described as too good to be true martini, but at least let's hope there's a flicker of opportunity here. Ed Morrissey writing over at Hot Air, but quoting liberally from Reuters. Here's what Reuters says. North Korea has expressed its commitment to complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula and is not seeking conditions. South Korean President Moon Jae-in said on Thursday, as the United States vowed to maintain maximum pressure on Pyongyang. Moon said big-picture agreements about denuclearization, establishing a peace regime, and normalization of relations between the two Koreas and the United States should not be difficult to reach through summits between the North and South and between the North and the United States. Quote, I don't think denuclearization has different meanings for South and North Korea. The North is expressing a will for complete denuclearization, Moon said, during a lunch with chief executives of Korean media companies. Quote again, they have not attached any conditions that the U.S. cannot accept, such as the withdrawal of American troops from South Korea. All they are talking about is the end of hostile policies against North Korea, followed by a guarantee of security. And as Ed points out, the definition of guaranteed security could definitely be a sticking point here. That could mean removing nuclear arms from the United States throughout the region, which would limit our ability to defend South Korea and Japan. Also, Jim, we've seen this act from North Korea before with the Clinton administration. We've seen it before in how they weaseled out of sanctions with the Bush and the Obama administrations. And it would appear that the sanctions and the serious threats of military action are having an effect on Kim Jong-un. Maybe he's getting serious about this, realizing it's not in his long-term interest. But based on the track record, we're going to need a whole lot more proof than what we've got so far.
Yeah, I don't want to overstate this, but a couple of things I think are starting to come together that might actually lead to a better result than we were, you know, ordinarily expect. One is that it sounds like North Korea is being fairly explicit about this. It certainly sounds like South Korea seems convinced. Now, maybe they're being a little too credulous, or maybe this is one of those situations because they want something to be true. They're more eager to believe it, confirmation bias. You have a feeling that if North Korea did not want this message to be getting out, they would very clearly say otherwise. Also, this is kind of raising expectations for this. And I think one of the things I've been thinking about in recent days is the degree to which both Kim Jong-un, who we very rarely have anything nice to say about, just an observation that he does have this kind of theatrical, grandiose, almost narcissistic personality. And that seems like something that President Trump would understand. Apparently, he's quoted somewhere in one of the other morning newsletters as saying, Trump's convinced that once he gets into the room with Kim Jong-un, he can reach a deal. That probably should make us a little bit worried. But it may be the sort of thing where the expectations of this summit get set so high that neither one of them really wants to walk away completely empty-handed. I've been reading about the Reagan-Gorbachev summits back in the mid to late 80s. And it's been kind of fascinating because a lot of them were not huge successes on substance. They actually started out pretty far apart in what they wanted in terms of arms reductions and SDI and things like that. But neither one of them wanted to walk away with the perception that the summit had completely failed, other than maybe the exception of Reykjavik. And so as a result of that, both leaders kind of put a lot of effort into getting to know the other and kind of creating the impression that even if they were disagreeing, they were doing so amiably. And I can't help but have a feeling that if expectations get set high enough, that Kim Jong-un is not going to want to, after having built up this summit and how he had gotten the President of the United States to sit down with him, and he was now being treated as a major world leader, and he was now on the same level. If he comes back and says, yeah, I couldn't reach a deal with Trump, then that might actually, both for both internal psychological reasons and also, I think, for the stature and standing of the regime, he wouldn't necessarily want that outcome. And certainly the same way with Donald Trump, although he did say yesterday, if he felt like negotiations weren't going anywhere, he would not be afraid to walk away from the table. I do kind of have this feeling that if, you know, as much as I'm was not initially a huge fan of it, I have this feeling that if you end up having the happy grip and grin photo op between the two leaders, that everybody might just feel a little more calm about it. Won't have changed the facts, but this, you know, they generally was this impact on U.S.-Soviet relations back in the late 80s. Not a perfect parallel. It's not exactly the same, but I do think maybe some good can come out of this. Now, I certainly wish that Trump was doing more extensive preparation for this, but I think the Pompeo trip was a good sign. And if the North Koreans really mean what they're saying, and obviously any denuclearization would require a system of verification, you know, international inspectors, things like that, then maybe North Korea realizes it's come up to the brink and it doesn't actually want to get into a conflict with the West. Thus, it's now looking at serious options to negotiate a climb down. So we'll see how things go from here. But I actually think these are better noises coming out of Pyongyang than we would have expected in a circumstance like this.
Yeah, I'd certainly like to believe it. So let's see if the South Korean president has the story straight as we get closer to whenever and wherever this summit happens. I'm glad you mentioned Reykjavik. It reminds me that that might very well be the beginning of the end of the Cold War right there, when Reagan committed to SDI and Gorbachev essentially realized that he was never going to be able to keep up with U.S. defense spending. Beginning of the end, I would say. And also, do you think if they're egos are similar, their negotiating styles may be similar, and so a Trump-Kim negotiation will look a lot like Trump negotiating on guns and immigration, and both sides make a lot of promises that look like concessions, and then none of them actually mean it.
Yeah, I didn't mean any of that stuff that I just said. No.
All right, let's move on to our bad martini now, and the headline of the CNN article is Starbucks will close 8,000 U.S. stores May 29th for racial bias training, which I assume that means they're trying to train people against engaging in racial bias, but it's a little bit ambiguous. It reminds me of the time, Jim, I was at choir practice at church, and this lady who had this real passion for helping exploited women and children stand up so excited and said, I finally got a job in human trafficking.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this as the controversy has you know flared all week long. We don't know exactly what happened in that Philadelphia store where two African-American men were asked to leave. They did not agree to do so. The cops were called and they were charged with criminal trespass. And people are asking somewhat fairly. There's no record of anyone saying, you know, they were bothering anyone, that there was some other issue, that they were disruptive, anything like that. And can you be charged with trespass in a public location that everyone else is allowed to do? And I think most people would say that there's a fairly common sense set of approaches to this that, you know, yes, it's a private store or restaurant or bar or something like that can ask you to leave. It would probably be good if that is a clear and uniform policy. It'd probably be good if that policy, if you're not going to post it up on the wall, then certainly on a company website or something like that to say, look, you know, we're only going to do this with cause. And Starbucks has a you know, wants every customer to walk away satisfied. So you can't be surprised that they're concerned about this. However, this is one incident in one store in Philadelphia. The manager in question who called the cops has been dismissed, departed the company. So you're left with the question, what do you want these, you know, tens of thousands of Starbucks employees across the country to do about this particular store manager? Perhaps this really was a matter of them being trigger happy, so to speak, in terms of calling the cops. Maybe it really was as bad as the protesters contend. But it would seem to me that, you know, the solution there is to address it with the manager, the person who did it, not to barge into the store and bellow at them through bullhorns, as you probably have seen in this picture from the Philadelphia Inquirer that's making the rounds. And of course, everyone, including myself, enjoys putting some sort of other words as the caption, things like, why do you keep misspelling my name on the cup? It's very simple. You know, only two people should use the milk and sugar station at one time. Three is anarchy. One is selfish. This is not hard. But people are pointing out a fairly serious point here, which is that, look, if you look at all the various initiatives that Starbucks has been involved with over the last decade or so, including ones on whether they would allow guns in their stores, this is a very progressive company, right? This is a company that is wants to be as woke as possible. It wants to be as on the side of the social justice warriors as much as they called. Remember, they called for, you know, discussions of how to fight racism. And, you know, so they have one incident at one store, by one decision by one store manager. And all of a sudden, the social justice warrior crowd, the left, is furious at them and calling for, you know, deleting the Starbucks app and protesting and you know, boycott Starbucks and all that stuff. Now, think about it. I go to Starbucks fairly regularly. I you know, I've been working in there on and off for a long time because it's a nice place to get coffee. The wireless is pretty good. And you can just be around in a public place. Suddenly, they're public enemy number one. They must feel like Emmanuel Goldstein in 1984, right? My sense would be when you feel like the criticism of your company has gone beyond the boundary of fairness, when you feel like the entire company is being demonized for the actions of one employee, the right thing to do is to stand up for your people and to say, no, this was one manager. We've dealt with this manager. We hate it when anybody gets treated badly, but we do not believe that there is a widespread problem of hatred and bias and racism within our staff. And instead, Starbucks knuckled under. And they're going through this giant training session and every store is going to close on May 29th. I'm sure it's great news for Pete's Coffee. And I don't know if Caribou Coffee is still around, but whatever your local independent coffee shop is doing, they must be doing thrilled about this. But I just kind of feel like Starbucks is really knuckling under to a fundamentally unfair and ever-shifting series of demands by the social justice warrior crowd. And, you know, when you have an issue at one store, deal with it at that one store. But don't assume that everybody else who works at your company from coast to coast is guilty of the same thing.
They want to keep their front row seat in the SJW parade. There's no doubt about that. That's why this is happening. So, you know, a lot of the crowd at Starbucks with the millennials and their beards. Maybe the razors at Dollar Shave Club aren't the thing they need most, but some of them can certainly use the hygiene products. So Dollar Shave Club is not just for razors, but if you only get the razors, you get a really great product. You get the weighty handle, the executive blades, fantastic shave. They come in the little sleeve. You get four every month, $1 per blade. Dollar Shave Club, very convenient. And then, of course, they've got a growing line of products as well. That leaves you feeling good, smelling good, and all sorts of things. And it can really streamline your routine in the morning, and it can streamline all the stuff you have on your vanity or in your medicine cabinet, wherever you keep it. Dollar Shave Club really makes life easier in this department. So if you've got too much clutter, if you're not happy with what you've got, and if you really hate going to the store, Dollar Shave Club is the way to go because it is more than razors, and it's way better than going to the store.
Dollar Shave Club has razors, shave butter, shampoo, body wash, toothpaste, everything you need to look, smell, and feel your best. I get an amazing high-quality shave every morning from my Dollar Shave Club Executive Razor. It is the best razor I have ever used. And, of course, the Dr. Carver's shave butter is fantastic. It goes on clear so you can see where you're shaving. Maybe best of all, Dollar Shave Club delivers everything to you. So you don't have to go to the store, schlep through the aisles, hunting for razors and shampoo and body wash and toothpaste. You don't have to look for any of it.
Clean up your bathroom and your morning routine by joining Dollar Shave Club today. And you can do it for just $5. With free shipping, you'll get the 6-blade executive razor plus trial sizes of the shave butter, the body cleanser, and the one wipe Charlie's. Then keep the blades coming for a few bucks more per month. Get yours at dollarshaveclub.com/martini. That's dollarshaveclub.com/martini. All right, Jim, let's move on to our crazy martini now. And for that, we go to the pages of the New York Post. Charity starts at home, but not if that home is Gracie Mansion. Mayor Bill de Blasio and his wife gave a grand total of $350 to charity in 2017 on an adjusted gross income of $223,449, according to tax returns they released on Tuesday. It marked a significant drop from the first couple's charitable giving in 2016 when de Blasio was up for re-election of $2,088 to charity. Asked about the donation gap, the mayoral spokesman responded that the mayor is not a rich man. He and the first lady helped their son pay tuition to one of the most expensive schools in the country, pointing out that tuition payments at Yale were north of $51,000. So, Jim, not to necessarily pick on the de Blasios, but $350 is pretty cheap, even if you are sending a kid through college. It reminds me of the time Al Gore, when he was vice president, gave about the same amount to charity. And then the next year, when he was launching his presidential campaign, lo and behold, he gave about $15,000 to charity. But of course, it's his boss who takes the cake for cheap donations. When Bill Clinton was governor of Arkansas, he famously donated his used underwear to charity. So, Jim, I guess the big takeaway from this story is that Democrats are super, super generous with everyone else's money, but for some of them, not so much when it comes to their own money.
You know, Greg, I figured he would have at least written one 4-figure check to save the groundhogs. For those wondering, why is Jim talking about groundhogs? You'd be a long-time listener to this program. No, New York Mayor Bill de Blasio is a serial killer of groundhogs. Okay, killed one on Groundhog Day a couple of years ago. He was supposed to lift it up, and he dropped it, and the groundhog landed on its neck. They took it back to the zoo. It was fairly obvious the groundhog was died. And yes, the zoo attempted to cover up the death of the groundhog. And in the meantime, you know, his Mayor de Blasio's never been brought to justice. Look, I just kind of think if you're going to be in public life and you're going to release your tax returns, write as many checks to as possible. Like maybe even the itemizing of Bill Clinton's underwear and stuff like that. I guess it's one of those things like if you want to make sure you get credit for every little bit of charity you can. And it's not about the $2 tax deduction. It's much more about the, hey, look, see what I did? See, I'm a nice guy. You know, and stuff. It is kind of intriguing that all of these people who keep talking about communitarianism and the need to reach out to each other and government is just another name for the things we choose to do together, like shut down kids' lemonade stands. All of a sudden, they turn into Ayn Rand when it comes to tax time. All of a sudden, when the charities come knocking, no, I am objectivist. You must stand on your own two feet. Yeah, indicating that they're, you know, it's one of those things where it, you know, besides, considering how you get the tax write-off, you figure for most of these people it would be worthwhile. To say nothing of the fact that, you know, you don't want to, you know, run for future office with a miserly reputation. New Yorkers have had considerable opportunities to choose somebody besides Bill de Blasio. They've kept choosing him. They've reelected him. Things have not gotten better. You kind of brought this on yourself, New York. I hate to tell this to you. You know, when I enjoy the city. I love the city. But look, guys, you've had options besides Bill de Blasio, and you keep sending him back. So don't complain now.
Well, I think I figured out the solution here, Jim, because, you know, Democrats think it's okay if you make up to $250,000, right? After that, you're obscenely rich and you don't get to keep as much of your money, at least as much of a percentage. He's at $223,000. So if he made $27,000 more, then I guess he would be a grossly obscene and stingy rich guy who doesn't care about the little guy. But until then, I guess not.
Greg, we could have and should have recommended this about a week ago, right before tax time. What you really need is the last day before you can claim the deduction. Plug your stuff into something like TurboTax. Government needs to have some sort of, you know, TurboTaxy. Plug in your information. We'll tell you what your tax bill is. And then a sort of a thing where you punch in, if I wrote a check to a charity today for $100, what how would that affect my return? If I did it for $200, and then just figure out how much you want to donate at the last possible minute to gain the maximum tax advantage. Now, for some returns, it may not be much of an advantage at all, but that would probably be a very good way to get people donating to good charities, which obviously is a good thing in and of itself, but also a sense of like, hey, you know, like you really have no excuse for missing out on this because you can help yourself while you're helping somebody else.
Good thought. The IRS site was down on the 17th. Sadly, I think it went back up probably. But
I was going to say, look, what do you know? Why would people need to reach the IRS website on a day like that, right, Greg?
if it was only that way all the time. Jim, have a great day. Talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And please visit our friends at Dollar Shave Club, dollarshaveclub.com/martini. Tune in again on Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.